Radio. 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 Radio Germaine. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this third episode. Welcome to the fourth episode of Thesis Focus.
Hello. Today we're joined by Dorothy, who's written a thesis on the historical and contemporary relationship between policing and indigenous groups over natural resource complaints in Canada, leading up to the creation of a specific new unit. Dorothy, thank you so much for joining us. Just to kick us off, is this something that's quite personal to you and your kind of story of getting interested in politics, right?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. This is such a great initiative, and I'm so stoked to be here. So I spent the last 6 or so years living up in Canada, and I mean, I'm a white settler living on stolen land, always have been. Over the last few years, started getting quite involved in some of these movements and spent a while out at the Ferry Creek blockade on Vancouver Island, which was technically, in terms of arrests, the Canada's largest act of civil disobedience. And out there was when I had my first encounters with this police force and saw with my own eyes for the first time, you know, because of the privilege that I've had growing up, the just amount of state violence and force that's being used to push forward extractive projects. And so from there, once you see that, you can't really look away. And so got quite involved in some of those movements and then ended up studying this for my thesis.
And so your experience of this protest was also your first experience with this particular police unit that you have written your thesis on. Could you just talk about what interested you in this unit particularly?
Yeah, so, you know, Canada's really quite interesting because, I mean, they have a great PR team and they have all these claims of being an environmentally forward country and to really prioritizing reconciliation with Indigenous communities, yet they've basically created an entire police force specifically dedicated to shutting down resistance to extractive projects. Basically, the Community Industry Response Group, which is the police force that I looked at, the CIRG, they were created as a subgroup of the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which is the traditional Mounties that are in so much pop culture, the friendly police on horses. And so basically, I was just so interested in understanding how can a country that claims to be so environmentally forward and has these commitments to be net zero by 2050 and that's committed to reconciliation with Indigenous communities, how could they possibly justify the creation of a police force that is breaking down peaceful Indigenous blockades with assault rifles and whatnot? How could they possibly justify that? So that got me into wanting to study the CIRG itself and seeing what its roots are and what is new about this and what's the same.
And there's definitely an element of novelty in what's going on with the CIRG. But I think what you really highlight in your thesis is that the current conflicts, as well as the current response of the government, are actually well embedded into the history of Canada and the police in Canada.
Yeah, exactly. And while this police force is a new one, the existence of the police dedicated to facilitating Indigenous land dispossession for the sake of settler capital accumulation is nothing new.
This is a big sentence. Let's get into it, like all of those different terms and where what you refer to, maybe.
Yeah, well, before Western Canada, which is where British Columbia is, where I was doing my research, before that was even brought into the settler colonial state of Canada, it was already a corporate resource monopoly. So the Hudson's Bay Company set up shop a few hundred years ago. And basically, they were a quasi-sovereign authority that had their own sort of police force to remove Indigenous people from their lands in order to access resources. At first, it was the fur trade. And then as British colonialism expanded westward throughout Canada, they ended up purchasing the land that's now known as British Columbia from the Hudson's Bay Company. The origins of the police in Canada, which was the Northwest Mounted Police, which eventually became the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP, which the CIRG is now a part of, that was created basically to escort white settlers westward across Canada and to remove Indigenous peoples from their lands so that the settlers could have access to land and the resources. And so in those earlier years of settler colonialism, there were a lot of really restrictive policies that the government put forth. This included the Indian Act and the creation of the reserve system, which basically forced communities into smaller parcels of land, the residential school system, which was horrendous, and just really restricted the movement and freedom of Indigenous communities while granting that same liberal freedom to the white settlers who were being pushed into their territories. And it's also important to note the treaty process. So in most of Canada, treaties were signed between the colonial government and the Indigenous communities to access their land. These treaties were really not symmetrical by any means, and communities were mostly coerced into signing them or just outright forced. But by the time that the settlers got to Western Canada and British Columbia, they were kind of fed up with the whole treaty process. They couldn't really be bothered. So most of the lands in British Columbia were never ceded or surrendered by the Indigenous communities to the federal government. So the government and the existence of it on those lands today is based on those foundations. It was never handed over to them.
Okay, so if we look back to the foundations of the Canadian police, we see that it's this colonial escort, basically. How did the police develop out of that in the years between the foundation of Canada and today?
So in those earlier years, as I mentioned, there was a lot of really blatant restrictive policies. And so then as time evolved, so towards the later part of the 20th century, there were a lot of really big and prominent high-profile Indigenous movements, largely centered around land rights and title. So this included the Oka Crisis, the Ipperwash Crisis, Gustafson Lake Standoff. And there were so many really big and powerful blockades that really pushed this issue to the forefront of public attention for the first time. And the police were suddenly becoming under a lot of heavy fire for their heavy-handed tactics used against these land defenders. So from there was these shifts to what was called the measured approach and the emergence of legal liberalism and this idea that the police would respect the right to peaceful protest. They're going to be culturally sensitive and it's going to be all about public safety and proper dialogue with communities and land defenders and protesters. And so while on the outside they were making some of those changes, at least to gesture towards that, they were also really ramping up their physically coercive capacities. There was much more surveillance. They were stocking up less lethal weapons and becoming a lot more militarized at the same time. And this emphasis on the measured approach and whatnot, it was really used to mask a lot of that coercion. And then how we saw that evolve into the early 2000s was super interesting. You know, as I've talked about, the police have always kind of existed to facilitate capitalism, land dispossession, extraction. But then that became so much more formalized and institutionalized in the early 2000s because for the first time, private resource companies were actually being invited into the security arena, into these briefings with CSIS, which is the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, and the RCMP, so the police. And they were playing a really big role in influencing their priorities. And so then that led to the shift towards critical infrastructure protection. And so basically pipelines and similar projects like that were labeled as critical infrastructure. So then from there, any act of resistance against them could be classified as an act of terrorism. So then once you have that, and then all of these big, powerful interests in oil and gas and in similar industries, that then justified having a lot more police presence, a lot more surveillance, especially of Indigenous communities who were resisting these projects. And so there were massive surveillance networks that were uncovered by some scholars such as Crosby and Monahan. And that then really sets the stage for the creation of the CURG, which is kind of the culmination of the increasingly close relationship between the police and the natural resource industry as it evolved over the decades.
And so in your thesis, you use the phrase settler colonial pacification, which refers to the use of state power to promote settler capitalist interest while facilitating Indigenous land dispossession. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so basically, settler colonial pacification basically refers to the attempt of imperial powers to maintain their control over indigenous peoples and their lands so that they can get their resources, while also at the same time trying to hide the history and contemporary nature of what's going on by building new societies on top of that. That's kind of the logic of settler colonialism. The pacification process is really ongoing, and it's dynamic and constantly evolving to the forms of resistance that are coming up or public pressure and whatnot. And so there's this dialectical relationship between pacification and resistance. And as I saw through studying the Kyrgyz and how they're trying to adapt to what is socially acceptable in 2024 when Canada's claiming to be this reconciliation and environmental leader and using all these terms to try and make themselves seem a bit more palatable, that's all part of the settler colonial pacification process. So is the creation of the Kyrgyz itself. There's a reason why they felt that they had to create a brand new police force to shut down these movements.
And so to bring it back to your specific findings and these specific resource conflicts, one of the things that you mention is that infrastructure plays a really important part in asserting the colonial state's right over the land that it's occupying or the land that it's contesting. Could you just describe to us what the specific resource conflict that you were studying was, the Wet'suwet'en context?
The Wet'suwet'en First Nation is a group that's up in northern British Columbia. They, like most other Indigenous groups in the region, have never ceded their land to the government. Wet'suwet'en territory is kind of in the route of a lot of different proposed pipelines and natural resource projects. There's a lot of resources up in the region. So this specific project is the Coastal GasLink pipeline, and it is owned by TC Energy, TransCanada Energy. They proposed the project back in 2012. It's a massive pipeline going from eastern British Columbia to Kitimat, which is a town on the coast. It's meant to transport LNG, liquefied natural gas, to export to mostly Asian countries. As soon as they proposed the project, the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs have rejected it. But a lot of the elected band council chiefs have been in favor of the project. Just a brief overview of the hereditary versus band council conflict, and I can't speak on this too much. It's not really my place, but in short, before the arrival of European settler colonialism, Indigenous communities across North America had their own ways of organizing themselves and government structures, and for many, including the Wet'suwet'en, it was under a hereditary system, and so it was hereditary leadership. But then when the Europeans arrived, they were like, what? Not democracy? We need democracy, and enforced an elected system, and that was established in the Indian Act. It's often the case, not always, but often in a lot of these resource movements between Indigenous communities and the government, where it is the hereditary leaders, the ones who would traditionally be in charge of making decisions around the land, who are opposed to the projects, whereas the band council is more in favor of the project. And often the band council, the elected chiefs, have a closer relationship with the government. Oftentimes there's a lot of coercion that's going on there. And especially in the case of the Coastal GasLink pipeline, a lot of the elected chiefs were sort of bought out. So going back to the pipeline project, so the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs from the beginning have said, no, we don't want this pipeline. They began to establish some blockades. So this includes Unist'ot'en camp and the Gidimden camp. And so Unist'ot'en camp was actually built 15 years or so ago to resist another pipeline that was proposed to go through the region, the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline that ended up falling through, largely because of the Wet'suwet'en resistance against it. So then when Coastal GasLink went to try and start to build the pipeline, the Unist'ot'en, which is one of the groups within the Wet'suwet'en First Nation, reestablished this blockade. And then the pipeline company got an injunction, which basically you go to the courts and the court grants an injunction that says that it is now illegal to be blocking access to whatever project. And that then warrants a police response. So then around that time, a second blockade was established on Wet'suwet'en territory on the same access road. And this is called Gidimden Camp. It's about 20 kilometers away from Unist'ot'en Camp. And then between then and now, there have been 3 major police raids to try and break down the blockades.
And so the Kyrgyz are the kind of chief actors in these police raids, right? So how did we get to this point? What was the process by which they became, you know, the people you call when you've got a resource conflict?
As I'd mentioned, in the last many years, there's been this increasingly close relationship between the police and the natural resource industry. There's really, really little public information available about this unit. The only real public information out there is 6 sentences on the RCMP's website. So there hasn't been any academic research on the Kyrgyz yet because of how new they are. But thankfully, there's a lot of investigative journalists and activists who have already put out a ton of information about the Kyrgyz from access to information requests, which I'll explain. But people like Brett Forrester, Molly Murphy, Matt Simmons have really uncovered a lot of great work. So I was using a lot of the access to information requests that they had originally filed.
So these access to information requests, what kind of documents are they allowing you access to, and what did you learn from those documents?
Sure. So from these access to information requests, I received around 2,000 pages of internal police emails, structure documents, budgets, complaints against the police, etc. The access to information requests that I filed were not new ones. You can file what's called an informal access to information request, and then you get it within like a month or so. Doing this and looking at access to information requests was really important for understanding the modes of power themselves, how they described what happened, what was going on behind the scenes, what kind of wording that they were using to justify their really violent actions and also their creation in the first place. And, you know, I think that so often academic research focuses on the communities that have been the subjects of power, and while it's important, it's also perpetuated a lot of really harmful power dynamics within academia and whatnot. So for this, through access to information requests, you can look at the sources of power themselves and work to break them down, which was really the point of my research. But it was really challenging because a lot of the pages are super heavily redacted. So there's still a lot of information that you just can't get access to. And so there's a lot that's going on behind closed doors.
So in terms of the stuff that you could uncover, what does this tell you about how the Kyrgyz works and how the people inside it are thinking?
A good place to start would be the foundational documents of the Kyrgyz and why they justified their creation and existence in the first place. The business case document basically said that we need a new police force to respond to resource projects, specifically the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which had just received approval from the federal government, and there had already been a lot of protests against it. They had also cited Standing Rock, which had just happened the year before in the U.S., and they said, oh, basically we have reason to believe that people will try and bring Standing Rock up here to Canada. You know, we need to make sure that that doesn't happen. We need a police force to ensure that this all happens smoothly and that this pipeline is able to be put in the ground without that much resistance. So we can already see from there that the purpose of this police force, the community industry response group, is to protect pipelines and similar resource projects. And in the documents, it also says that this is meant to be, you know, a temporary measure. It's just mainly for this pipeline, but we can extend it more if we want to. And that's what they've done. I was looking at some of their other internal foundational documents that explained how they're structured and how they operate and whatnot, and they really emphasize the measured approach.
This idea of a measured approach is actually really interesting because that's one of the later developments of the techniques and rhetoric that the police uses in the Canadian context. Could you kind of detail what that's made of and how it justifies action?
Sure. So basically, the measured approach reflects the shift in policing in a lot of Western countries back in the 90s, to where the police would say, oh, you know, we really respect the right to peaceful protest. We, you know, want to prioritize public safety and impartial attitudes between industry and protesters, a way to make what they're doing seem a lot more palatable and in line with societal norms. As we'll see later, those have been really weaponized to justify some really violent and coercive and just blatantly contradictory actions.
What we see is this very kind of liberal democratic rhetoric around policing, but what I think you're saying is that actually this rhetoric doesn't necessarily reflect the practice of the way in which they're engaging with these communities. And in fact, actually, you go further than that, right? And you say the rhetoric itself is part of the way the violence gets integrated in this police response.
Yeah, it's exactly that. And I guess that's maybe a good transition to talk about the next part of my research, which is how they acted on the ground in Wet'suwet'en territory to enforce the injunction and to remove the blockades. So when the police showed up, it starts with a bit of a attempted negotiation process where they're called the Division Liaison Team officers, the DLT officers. They're the guys that go and do all the discussions, and they're usually indigenous themselves, and their job is to kind of try and convince the land defenders to take down the blockades while also collecting surveillance. That's another really big part of their job that then is reported back up the chain of command. So then when the land defenders do not take down the blockades, the Kurg goes in and violently breaks them down and arrests the land defenders. And so in the three raids on Wet'suwet'en territory in 2019, 2020, 2021, there were officers in full-on militarized gear, assault rifles, there were attack dogs. You know, there were really violent scenes.
One of the most chilling things that I found was the concept of lethal overwatch.
Yeah, so basically there were some documents that were leaked to The Guardian. I have not seen them myself. They came across internal police documents about this raid saying that lethal overwatch was required. And basically what that means is the presence of officers with sniper rifles or with guns, just in case they're needed. And in these same documents, the police had also said that they had no reason to believe that the land defenders would be violent, which was the case. They were not violent. And that goes into this whole rhetorical game that the police have played to try and make land defenders look like they're these violent criminals, and that justifies this massive show of force. And so the police often say, oh, but we didn't use them. We didn't use them on the people. But in what kind of coercive message is that getting across? It's like, if you do not do what we want you to do, which is to take down the blockade, there are threats of guns and dogs and whatnot in the criminal justice system, land defenders getting arrested and not being allowed back onto their territory as part of their release conditions.
And in the short term, this has been effective, right? Like the blockade breakup in 2019 did lead to a capitulation on the part of the Wet'suwet'ens.
Basically, in the 2019 raid, and this is a really good example of just how coercive this police force has been. So the raid started at Gidimden camp, and it was super violent. They arrested like 14 people, and by the time that they'd arrested everyone and started moving up the road to Unistaten camp, which is mostly a small group of women, matriarchs who were living there, by the time it was starting to arrive to them, they had agreed to take down the blockade because they had seen all the violence that had happened down at Gidimden, and they knew that they were next. Then the police turned that around and heralded it as the success of their negotiation tactics. And like, look, we were able to negotiate a solution that worked out for everyone. And it's like, no, that is the essence of your coercive capabilities.
Yeah, and I think this really goes back to this idea of a whole measured approach in which the police says that their only purpose is to frame negotiations. But I think the title of your thesis really refers to that negotiation can't be done at gunpoint. From the moment you have all of these coercive means, the negotiation is biased and is asymmetrical to start with.
Yeah, exactly. And each time that there is some sort of blockade, they do attempt to negotiate. They attempt to say to the land defenders, oh, you know, is there anything we can do to convince you to take down this blockade? But like, when they're doing that with assault rifles and dogs, and even without that, the massive amount of power that the state and the police have, that's never going to be a symmetrical negotiation. And so then when the land defenders refuse to take down the blockades and say that, no, we're upholding our own Wet'suwet'en law, then the police can say, oh, well, you know, we tried to negotiate, and then breaking down the blockade with guns. Like, that's not symmetrical.
And the only thing they are negotiating here is indeed consent, I guess.
Exactly.
Now, you just pointed to something that's very interesting, I think, in the interaction of different laws. And I think one of the reasons why this case study is also so interesting is that it's about more than a pipeline. Like, the pipeline is definitely the object of contention, but the conflict around it and the tensions really reveal some cracks in the legitimacy of the Canadian state. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Indigenous resistance movements, they pose two main threats to the settler colonial state. So on one hand, it's the financial one. They are damn good at shutting things down, blocking access to resources, shutting down roads, and have demonstrated that. There's so much people power there. And then on the other hand, there's this existential legitimacy threat that they pose. So the foundations of the settler colonial existence on this land is one of dispossession. They never had even legal grounds. And so by blocking a road or blocking access to a project and just outwardly resisting those settler colonial laws, that challenges the legitimacy of the state. And so that's another reason why the police have sought so hard to shut these movements down, because they cut to the very essence of what the settler colonial state is. The Wet'suwet'en resistance to the Coastal GasLink pipeline and the creation of the Kyrg and their attempts to pacify this resistance are really representative of the state of contemporary settler colonialism in Canada, and a reminder that this is not something that's just the past that, you know, we've moved on from. And the pacification process, or the attempt at pacifying Indigenous communities, is an ongoing process that's constantly evolving to try and do so in the most strategically effective way. And the Kyrg is just the newest manifestation of that. The Wet'suwet'en case in particular has really highlighted a lot of these tensions to the general public as well. I think that there's still a lot that needs to be done, but for instance, around the time of the 2020 raids, in response, the country was basically shut down by resistance movements across the country, shutting down roads and ports and railways. And it really has forced it into the public psyche. But at the end of the day, I mean, the pipeline was built. LNG is going to start flowing.
So, yeah, I think what we see from your thesis in general is really both the reality of the durability of the colonial state, but then also these, you know, contradictions and these opportunities to challenge and to undermine and to provoke the kind of logics that it's built on. And I think, you know, you as a scholar, or also as much as an activist, you're not just trying to document, you're also trying to influence, right?
Yeah, on one hand, the pipeline has been built and gas is going to start flowing later this year. And the police did achieve their short-term goal in removing the blockades. But to leave it at that would be such a disservice to those who are out there and resisting, and also not even a full picture of the implications of all of this. And I think that this has really raised a lot of conversations about the role of police. I mean, we're already in major international discussions around police reform, especially following the murder of George Floyd in the US back in 2020. But how can you reform a system that was created for the very purposes that the police in Canada were created for, which was to facilitate Indigenous land dispossession? And this is kind of the same across all settler colonial states. You can point to British colonial policing in Ireland, and, you know, it's very similar in the US, although it had some geographic differences. So for instance, in the northeast of the US, the police were created to shut down strikers and those types of resistance movements. In the southeast, it was to catch runaway slaves. And then in the west, it was to, kind of like up in Canada, facilitate Indigenous land dispossession for settler accumulation. And how can you reform that? And so I don't know if I have anything really to propose there, but I think so much hope can be taken from these movements themselves. I mean, to be standing up in the face of so much power, not only the physical power, but the discursive power that justifies these acts of coercion, which I talked a lot about in my thesis. There's not much positive you can take from this other than the fact that people are still resisting and people are still pointing towards the cracks.
Thank you so much, Dorothy, for asking those questions out loud and putting them back at the center of the conversation. I think it's really key in the environmental movements today. And thank you for putting a spotlight on this specific situation and coming here to explain it to us.
So if anyone wants to hear more from Dorothy or is interested in reading her thesis, then we'll leave her LinkedIn in the bio. And we've also asked her for a couple of materials for people who are interested in exploring the area further. And we'll leave those in the description as well.
Thank you so much for having me.